Xander fingered the lapels of my dinner jacket, as if intrigued by the stitching.
"You've worked hard, Mr. Sinclair. You've found so much about your friend, the tragic English doctor."
"Little you didn't know already."
"I tried to help you. Was Halder useful?"
"As always. He could run a guided tour for the tourists. He's given himself a starring role in the last act."
"That I heard. He's very ambitious. He wants my job."
He waved to Halder, who was watching him from across the swimming pool.
"A nice boy. He thinks he's German, like I think I'm a Frenchman. We're both wrong, but my mistake is bigger. To the French, he's a nègre, while I am an Arab."
He stared bleakly at the party, and then rallied himself, his awareness of his own corruptibility giving him confidence.
"We can help each other, Mr. Sinclair, now that you work for me."
"Do I?"
"Naturally. Come and see me. I'll tell you more about Dr. Greenwood. Maybe about your neighbors."
He left me and swayed through the crowd, affable and devious in a way I found almost likable. Halder and I were not alone in keeping watch on the security chief. On a third-floor balcony of the Villa Grimaldi stood Alain Delage, fastening the cufflinks of his dress shirt as he gazed over the crowded terraces. Beside him was Olivier d'Estivelle, the elderly banker who had succeeded the murdered Charbonneau as chairman of the Eden Olympia Holding Company. Together they followed Xander's progress as he wandered through the guests, slipping an arm around every woman who smiled at him. D'Estivelle spoke into a mobile phone, and he and Delage withdrew into the high-ceilinged room behind them. Despite Halder's assurance, I was certain that Jane was still somewhere within the Villa Grimaldi, as Xander had told me. I climbed the steps to the upper terrace and strolled towards the entrance, where signs pointed to the cloakrooms. A flunky in a brocaded uniform guarded the staircase, flicking the elastic bands of his white gloves.
"Toilette? Tout droit, monsieur."
The door of the women's cloakroom opened, and a young German actress emerged, her mobile nostrils moving like hoses around her upper lip, hoovering up the last specks of powder. She exchanged quips with the flunky and let him admire her décolletage. I walked to the staircase and climbed the deep maroon carpet. I'd reached the half-landing when the flunky turned from his inspection and shouted,
"Monsieur, c'est privé!"
Careful not to break step, I called down,
"Monsieur d'Estivelle, troisième étage?"
He saluted and let me go, too bored to follow me up the stairs. I paused on the first floor and strolled past the lavish public rooms with their gilt ceiling liners and empire furniture. In the dining room, the tables were already laid with breakfast cutlery. A pantry door opened, and kitchen staff shouted above the blare of music from the terrace. A waiter sang to himself, setting silver cruets on a trolley, ignoring me when I returned to the staircase. The next floor appeared to be disused, teak barriers shutting off the unlit corridors. I moved up the steps to the third floor, where the landing opened into a large reception suite, chandeliers glowing from the high ceiling. Voices, masculine and multilingual, sounded nearby. In a side chamber, a lacquered table was laid with maps and aerial photographs, and I stopped to examine a detailed projection of the Var plain between Nice and Grasse. Ground leases marked out in red crayon defined the planned expansion of Eden Olympia into a vast urbanization larger than Cannes itself. In front of me, open connecting doors gave onto a formal drawing room. A television set stood on a blackwood table, watched by a man in evening dress sitting on a gilt chair. Without turning, he raised a hand and beckoned me into the room. I walked towards my reflection in the mantelpiece mirror, crepe tie hanging from the soft collar of Francis's shirt, like a poet's cravat.
"Come in, Paul. I was hoping you'd find me here."
Wilder Penrose greeted me affably, lifting his huge body from the chair. As always, I was struck by how pleased he was to see me. He stood up and embraced me, hands patting the pockets of my dinner jacket, as if searching for a concealed weapon. He tapped my cheek with his open palm, forgiving me for the mild subterfuge that had given me access to the villa. Once again I realized that my role was to play the naive and impressionable younger brother.
"Do join me, Paul."
He pointed with the remote control to a nearby chair.
"How's the party?"
"Hard work. I should have borrowed a wheelchair."
"Did the footman tell you that I was on the way up?"
"Security, Paul. We're obsessed by it. You walk in wearing an assassin suit and ask for the chairman. You're lucky you weren't shot dead."
"I was looking for Jane. She's here somewhere."
"She's resting in one of the bedrooms. I'll explain where to find her."
Penrose turned back to the television screen.
"Have a look at this footage before you go. Handheld cameras are so jerky, but you get a sense of what's happening."
"Recent therapy classes?"
"Of course. The teams are doing well."
He pressed the remote control. Propelled by the fast-forward button, a sequence of violent images rushed past. A confused medley of accelerating cars, running feet, doors being hurled from their hinges, startled Arabs in alcoves, and shocked women staring across disheveled beds. The sound was turned down, but I could almost hear the screams and truncheon thuds. Headlights veered across an underground car park, where a trio of olive-skinned men lay on the concrete floor, pools of blood around their heads.
"Brutal stuff!"
Penrose grimaced with distaste, and switched off the video, relieved to see the blank screen.
"It's getting more difficult to steer the therapy classes. We've seen enough."
"Don't stop on my account."
"Well, I don't think you should watch too much. It's bad for your morale."
"I'm touched. This may be the only censored film showing in Cannes. All the same, you're looking at some really nasty clips."
"Context, Paul. You have to see it within its therapeutic frame. Routine heart surgery can easily resemble something out of a nightmare. Camcorder film is misleading. It's hungry for the color red, so it turns everything into a bloodbath."
Aware that he was trying too hard to convince me, he said,
"It's in a good cause. Eden Olympia and the future. Richer, saner, more fulfilled, and vastly more creative.
A few sacrifices are worth it if we produce another Bill Gates or Akio Morita."
"The victims will be glad to hear it."
"Do you know? They might. Petty criminals, clochards, AIDS-riddled whores. They expect to be abused. We're doing them a good turn by satisfying their unconscious expectations."
"So it's also therapy for them?"
"Well put. I knew you'd understand. I wish everyone did."
For once Penrose seemed distracted, openly gnawing at a thumb.
"Keeping a close eye on things can be tricky. I sense a change of direction. Too many of the teams are starting to treat the therapy classes as sporting events. I try to explain that I'm not interested in running a football league. It's their imaginations I want them to use, not their boots and fists."
"Xander would agree with you.
He thinks you're infantilizing them."
"Xander?"
"Yes. His idea of crime comes with a secret Swiss account number. He can't understand why we're developing all this expertise and not putting it to good use. In some ways, he's rather dangerous."
"Doesn't he have a point?" All games infantilize, especially when you're playing with your own psychopathy. You begin by dreaming of the Übermensch and end up smearing your shit on the bedroom wall. You're right, Paul. Solemnly, Penrose gripped my hand, nodding at the blank television screen. The teams have to work harder and learn to fight their way into the darkest heart of themselves. I hate to do it, but I need to turn up the ratchet until the nerve strings sing with anger. He turned to the window as a firework rocket whistled through the night air and exploded in a puffball of crimson light. A flush of animation touched his face and faded as the rocket spent itself and fell to earth. He seemed more driven than I first remembered him, frustrated by the sluggish reflexes of his senior executives and their flagging will to madness. Seated in this formal empire room, he was hemmed in by the caution of the executive mind. Though I hated everything he had done, and hated myself for failing to report him to the French authorities, I felt almost sorry for him. Mired in its mediocrity, the human race would never be insane enough for Wilder Penrose. "Now, Paul," he noticed me sitting beside him in Greenwood's dinner jacket, "you're looking for Jane?" "Halder saw her earlier. He said she's rather tired." "The film was a bit of an ordeal. Swiss bankers don't have the popular touch. The only people they meet are billionaires and war criminals. Jane still works too hard. She should join one of our new therapy groups for women."
"Are there any?"
"Paul, I'm joking. Or at least I hope I am." He walked me to the door, an avuncular club man with a favoured guest. "In the case of women, the system of imposed psychopathy is already in place. It's called men." I paused by the map table and its vision of a greater Eden Olympia. "This ratchet, Wilder, are the murders we saw part of it?"
"Murders?"
"The video you were playing. The three Arabs in the garage looked awfully dead."
"No, Paul."
Penrose lowered his head, his eyes drifting away from me. "I assure you, everyone recovered. As usual, large bundles of francs were handed over. Think of these people as film extras, paid for a few minutes' discomfort."
"I'll try to." "No murders?"
"None." "Who put the idea into your head? Be careful with Xander. He's an unhappy man, driven by powerful resentments. Some of his personal habits are disgusting. He may well be the only natural psychopath in Eden Olympia."
"And our very own police chief?"
"Sadly, there's a long tradition of the two roles coinciding. Senior policemen are either philosophers or madmen."
The suites on the fourth floor were dark and unoccupied. Following Penrose's directions, I walked the long corridor, past the gilt-framed mirrors, whose surfaces had been dulled by time. In the entrance to the west wing, I noticed that a pair of carved oak doors stood ajar. I stepped through them, switched on a table lamp, and found myself in a well-stocked gun room. The barred cabinets were filled with shotguns and sporting weapons. Six NATO-issue automatic rifles occupied one cabinet, chained together through their trigger guards. A notice board leaned against an easel, listing the fixtures of the Eden Olympia Gun Club. The names of the members, all senior executives at the business park, formed a set of rival leagues that I assumed were run independently of Wilder Penrose. Pinned to the board were photographs of well-set men in their 50s, clipped from the financial pages of a local Arab-language newspaper. In a corner behind one of the double doors was a large department store dump bin, filled with what I first thought
were gunnery-range targets in the form of animal cutouts. I held several of them to the light, and then recognized stuffed toy versions of the Dormouse, the Hatter, and little Alice herself. I laid the Alice back in the bin, and watched the eyelids swivel and close over the glassy stare, almost the first untroubled sleep I had seen in Eden Olympia. To the rear of the west wing, far from the terrace party and the fireworks, a waiter was moving a drinks trolley into the corridor. I stopped beside him and scanned the debris of glasses and crushed napkins. Sharing a tumbler with a champagne cork was an empty serrette. "Madame Delage," I asked. "Dr. Sinclair."
"Monsieur, they sleep now?"
"Good. Like Alice." I pressed a few coins into his hand, stepped past him into the suite and closed the door. A single standard lamp lit the empty sitting room, its glow warming the deep pile of a fur stole lying across an armchair. A coarse masculine odor hung in the air, a blend of sweat and genital steroids, the unmistakable spoor of a man in rut. A bottle of Laphroaig stood on the mantelpiece, and I guessed that a passionate suitor had fortified himself for the rigors of the bed. Pools of malt whiskey lay around the legs of a carriage clock and stained a Palais des Festivals film program. The sound of running water came from the bathroom. I listened with my hand on the doorknob, uneager to catch Simone Delage in the act of clipping her toenails.
"Jane?"
She was sitting on the tiled floor between the bath and the bidet, knees drawn against her chest, her left hand trailing in the flow of water from the bath tap. She wore a man's black silk dressing gown that lay like a shadow across the white tiles. Her face was composed, but the blush of a hard slap still burned on one cheek. Propped in the bidet was the patent leather handbag that served as her off-duty medical valise. Her hand covered the syringe lying on the porcelain rim.
"Paul,"
she greeted me with a faint tremor of the lips. She raised her chin, focusing on my eyes and mouth, and then took my hands, as if she needed to assemble in stages a recognizable image of her husband. She seemed almost asleep, her voice slurred.
"Glad you came, Paul. I wasn't sure."
"I had to come. I guessed you'd be here."
"So many parties in Cannes tonight. We saw the Eden Olympia film."
"Any good?"
"Depressing. Everyone's so happy in Cannes, and they make these depressing films. Did you see any?"
"One or two." "Not the kind in competition."
"Depressing?"
"Very." I sat on the edge of the bath and turned off the tap. I pointed to the inner door.
"Is Simone?" "She's sleeping in the bedroom."
Jane tightened the dressing gown, her childlike shoulders swamped by the black silk.
"You look smart, Paul. I like the dinner jacket."
"It was David's. It doesn't really fit." She nodded at this and touched my sleeve.
"It suits you. Wear it all the time."
"Frances Baring loaned it to me. God knows why she kept it."
"So she won't forget David. He's everywhere still, isn't he?"
She straightened her hair in the wall mirror.
"Too many mirrors in this house. Paul, tell me how you escape inside them."
"You don't need to escape. Just take things easier. Wilder agrees you work too hard."
"Wilder agrees with you about everything. That way you do what he wants."
She smiled with the first affection I had seen since our decision to stay.
"Dear Paul, you crash-landed your plane here and can't climb out."
I listened to the boom of rock music, a dull pulse like a week-long headache. An odd smell caught my nostrils.
Jane?
Was Sander here?
Sander?
She closed her eyes.
Why ask?
I saw him on the terrace. The cologne he was using. I could smell it when I came in.
Nasty, isn't it? Reminds him of Beirut.
She felt the bruise on her cheek.
It doesn't matter, Paul. High up here in Supercan, nothing matters.
I held her hand, chilled by the cold tap water, and noticed the torn skin on her wrist, blood clotting between the tendons.
Did Sander do this?
I fell over. Sander was very drunk. He thinks he has serious problems at Eden Olympia.
They want him out. He knows where the bodies are buried. And they've seen him sharpening his spade. What was he doing here?
Alain set up one of his little games. He didn't tell me Sander was going to play.
What happened?
They pushed him into the bedroom and locked the door.
Where were you?
In the bed.
Jane shrugged inside the dressing gown.
He was too drunk.
I sat on the floor and touched her bruised cheek.
Jane, we should leave.
Now?
She gripped her bag, as if holding tight to a lifebelt.
Can't leave, Paul. Taking my medicine.
All this diamorphine. You'll kill yourself.
I'm fine.
Jane squeezed my hand, the doctor reassuring an anxious relative.
I know how much to take. That's what medical school is really for. All the doctors at the clinic need help to relax.
Let's pack tonight and set off for London. We can be in Lyon by morning.
Jane, we've spent too long in Eden Olympia. I'll stay.
She spoke in a sleepy but firm voice.
I'm really happy here. Aren't you? Talk to Wilder.
I have. He's downstairs, watching his pornographic films.
Lucky man. I have to cope with too much Belgian angst. Alain and Simon are quite prudish in their own way.
They're degrading you.
I know. That's why I became a hippie, to see if I could cope with myself. Then all those caftans and dirty feet were a bit of a bore, so I turned into a doctor.
You kept the dirty feet.
And you still fell in love with me. I didn't wash for weeks. Now I have clean feet, and I'm turning into a slut again. But I do my job, and it doesn't matter. Tired of me,
she leaned her cheek against the tiled wall.
Go, Paul. Just go. Fly back to London.
Chapter 33. The Coast Road. Fireworks leapt into the night sky, ruby and turquoise umbrellas that formed huge cupolas over Supercan, canopies fit for a caliph's throne. Like a hashish dream, they faded and rejoined the dark. Along the Croisette, the flicker of flashbulbs marked the end of another premiere, and headlights glowed through the palm fronds as a motorcade left the Palais de Festival. Forgotten above the crowds, the samurai on the roof of the Noga Hilton gestured with his sword at the beach restaurants, where the studio parties were in full swing. I took a flute of champagne from a cruising waiter and thought of Jane, asleep against the bidet in the fourth-floor suite. Despite my knee, I was strong enough to carry her to a taxi, pack her into the Jaguar, and set off northwards with our passports. But once again I had hesitated. Just as I had postponed my decision to report Wilder Penrose to the police. In part, I resented Jane for no longer needing me. I knew that she would leave me at the first service station on the Paris autoroute, and hitch a lift to Cannes without a backward glance. If anyone needed me now, it was Penrose and his faltering dream of social madness, a larger version of that plane crash, from whose wreckage, as Jane had said, I had yet to free myself. The band had turned up its amplifiers, filling the air with immense blocks of reverberating sound. The social stratification of the guests had at last collapsed. In a new style peasants' revolt, the lawyers, civil servants, and police officials had climbed the steps to the middle terrace, overwhelming the actors and film agents. As if expecting the worst, the bankers and producers on the upper terrace stood with their backs to the Villa Grimaldi, an ancien régime faced with the revolution it most feared, a rebellion of its indentured professional castes. Francis Baring and Xander were alone on the lower terrace, dancing together by the swimming pool. Xander held his jacket like a matador's cape, urging Francis to lunge at him. Playfully, she let him chase her around the pool, watched by Halder, who sat on the diving board, his dark figure almost invisible against the night. Seeing me, Francis waved her purse. She whispered something to Xander, ducked beneath his groping hands, and ran from the pool. She embraced me, reeking of Xander's cologne. "Paul, don't ever try dancing with a secret policeman. I'm probably pregnant. Do you mind if we go?" "We leave now." I was glad to see her, but turned to face Xander, who was searching for the sleeves of his dinner jacket. "Just give me a moment." "What is it?" "Paul?" "I need a word with Xander." I flexed my shoulders. "He's about to be the first policeman I've ever punched."
"Why?"
Francis held my arm.
"I was joking. You sound like a Victorian father. He scarcely touched me."
"He touched Jane." I waited while Xander strode towards us, smiling with all his corrupt charm, as if our real evening together was about to begin. "Francis, wait here. It won't take long."
"Paul!"
she shouted above the music, shaking her head when Halder caught up with the security chief.
"I'm too tired to watch you three brawling."
"Right." I saw Halder raise a slim hand in warning. I could deal with Xander, but Halder would be too fast for me. "We'll go. I'll talk to Xander another time."
"Is Jane all right?"
Francis steered me down the path towards the car park.
"What happened to her?"
"Nothing. Xander came on a little too heavily."
"I'm sorry."
Francis handed her ticket to the valet parkers, and then gripped my arms.
"Forget about Xander. He doesn't matter. None of it matters."
"That's what Jane said." I almost believe it. We moved down the drive towards the gates, queuing behind the Saudi ambassador's Cadillac. Trying not to think of Xander, I realized that once again I had yielded to the greater status quo that was Eden Olympia. The business park set its own rules and had effectively switched off our emotions. Violence and aggression were only allowed within the therapeutic regime administered by Wilder Penrose, like rationed doses of a rare and dangerous medicine. Yet a brawl around the swimming pool of the Villa Grimaldi, in full view of the assembled judges and police chiefs, with Halder lightly hysterical and Xander wallowing in the deep end, would have been a breakthrough of almost surrealist proportions, a genuine lunge for freedom. I was tempted to tell Francis to turn back.
"Paul!"
She tapped my injured knee, waking me from my reverie.
"Look up there."
She pointed across the landscaped lawns to the conservatory entrance of the Villa Grimaldi, where we had parked after the Cardin Foundation robbery. Two immaculate black Mercedes straddled the flowerbeds, as if delivered straight from a showroom. Behind them was a commercial ambulance, with curtained windows, its Red Cross light switched off, the driver and his paramedic asleep in the front seat. Francis fumbled with the headlight switch, trying to read the ambulance's number plate.
"Toulon."
She seemed thrown by this.
"I told you they'd leased a lot of cars. Why bring an ambulance from Toulon?"
Watch the Cadillac. I held the wheel, avoiding the Saudi bumper. The ambulance is here for the party. Those elderly bankers have to be kept alive. As long as there's a pulse, the money flows. Francis stalled the engine and clumsily restarted it.
There's something on tonight. A ratissage.
Penrose would have told me. He's keen that I'm involved.
Only in the fun ones. The Rugger Club japes. This one is serious. Was Penrose here? He doesn't usually go to parties.
Francis, relax. I moved her edgy hand from the gear lever, trying to calm her.
He was upstairs, watching his videos.
Nasty stuff. He's starting to prescribe some really violent therapy.
Then do something about it. At least 6 senior judges were at the party.
And several police commissaires. I appear in a lot of the video footage. I don't want to spend the next 10 years in a Marseille jail. Besides, they turn a blind eye. They won't admit it, but the French upper class are deeply racist.
We left the gates of the Villa Grimaldi and set off along the high corniche. Despite her edginess, Frances drove at a leisurely pace, reluctant to change up from second gear. I lay back and let the last traces of Xander's cologne blow away on the night air. When we reached the Valoris Road, Frances stopped at the green traffic lights. Without moving her head, she pointed to the rearview mirror.
Frances? Let's go.
There's a car following us.
I gazed back at the darkened road, briefly lit by a salvo of fireworks. A car with dipped headlights approached us, drifting from the verge to the center line, as if the driver suffered from defective night vision.
Paul!
It's all right. He's looking for someone's villa.
No! He's after us! The car has Eden Olympia plates.
The car, a grey Audi, was 50 yards behind us when the traffic lights turned to red. Francis let out the clutch and accelerated across the empty intersection, turning right towards Golf Juan. The Audi driver cruised through the red lights and at the last moment swung round to follow us, his near side wheel clipping the curb. I pointed to the first side road.
Take a left here. He'll go by.
We turned into an avenue of small houses with well-stocked gardens. The reflector discs of parked cars glowed in our headlights. The Audi had stopped, as if the driver was unsure where we had gone. Then he pulled off the Valoris Road and resumed his unhurried pursuit.
Right, I told Francis. He's tailing us.
It's probably one of Halder's chums, keeping a routine watch over you. He's a real amateur. We'll soon lose him.
Him?
It might be a woman.
Jane?
She was too stoned to switch off the bath taps.
Anyway, she doesn't care about us.
Leaning against the door, I watched the Audi over my headrest. It swayed across the steep camber, and its wing mirror struck a parked van. The driver caught himself and straightened out, but soon drifted from left to right across the road. Below us, at the end of the avenue, was the RN7, the brightly lit coastal highway from Cannes to Golf Juan. We drove through the underpass, then paused at the junction. In the amber glare of the sodium lights, I watched our pursuer stop 30 yards behind us. A hand emerged from the driver's window and tried to reset the broken wing mirror on its mount.
Francis, you look exhausted.
Concerned for her, I tried to take the controls.
Pull in here. I'll get out and talk to him.
But Francis pressed on, joining the coast road towards Juan-les-Pins and Antibes. She gripped the wheel and glanced over her shoulder, as if fleeing from the night.
Francis, slow down.
Not now, Paul. Our friend isn't alone.
A few yards behind the stationary Audi were 2 large Mercedes limousines, similar models to those we had seen at the Villa Grimaldi. As the Audi followed us, they pulled out onto the RN7,
moving nose to tail with their headlights dimmed. The Audi driver seemed unaware of his black escort and was still grappling with the broken wing mount. We passed the old Ali Khan house beyond the railway tracks, a crumbling deco ghost above the beach. A slip road crossed the railway line and led to the harbour and waterfront bars of Golf Juan. Francis accelerated and hurled the little BMW through the dark air, wheels almost losing their grip on the unlit macadam. At the last moment she braked as we reached the railway bridge. The Audi was now 100 yards behind us, the driver irritated by the Mercedes trying to crowd him off the slip road. I saw a fist raised through the window, and his headlights flared when the tank-like limousine jolted his bumper. "Brake now! Harder!" I leaned across Francis and switched off the lights. I forced the wheel from her hands and slewed the BMW across the beach road. We hurtled into the car park of Tetu's and came to a neck-jarring halt, startling the young attendant who was dozing in an open-topped Bentley. The Audi sped past, its burly driver hunched over his wheel, followed by the two Mercedes, headlights on full beam, horns blaring as their drivers jockeyed like chariot racers. Too breathless to speak, Francis waved away the puzzled attendant. She lay back in the darkness and stared at the diners in the beach restaurant across the road. She seemed stunned but relieved, as if she had completed an exhilarating fairground ride and was ready to rejoin the strolling crowd.
"Paul."
She smoothed her hair, aware that I was watching her with interest.
"What is it?"
"Nothing. Let's go. They're heading for the beach road to Juan. We'll follow."
"Why? We've lost them, thank God. Those big cars look nasty."
"They weren't after us. They were chasing the Audi. You were right all along. It's a ratissage."
Watched by the perplexed attendant, we left the Tetu car park and drove into Golf Juan. Despite the film festival, most of the restaurants facing the marina had closed for the night. Guests were leaving a party aboard a motor yacht, typically making their way down a gangway. Visitors to a white township that emitted an ivory light like a floating cemetery.
"They've gone."
Francis searched the darkness for a turning. "We'll go back to the RN7.
They're up ahead. I want to see what happens."
"Forget about it. Did you recognize the man in the Audi?"
"Some tired dentist on his way home."
"He followed us. Why?"
"You? Not us. A midnight blonde on her way back from the festival with her pimp. Our vigilantes must have seen him and didn't approve. He looked a little Maghrebian. They'll teach him a lesson in racial respect."
Reluctantly, Francis drove along the darkened front. At the eastern edge of Golf Juan, a new apartment complex stood on the site of the ceramics factory I had once visited with my parents. The Audi was circling a nearby roundabout, chased by one of the Mercedes. Almost rolling the limousine onto its side, the driver rammed the rear of the Audi. The second Mercedes blocked the exit of the return road to Golf Juan. Its headlights shone on a violent game, a private demolition derby played out beneath the palm trees. Shards of broken glass from the Audi's taillights lay on the road, spitting like embers of a fire as the tires raked across them.
"Hold back for a second."
I tried to steady Francis, who seemed disoriented by the harsh collisions.
"He's decided to cut and run."
The Audi swerved from the roundabout, struck the curb, and set off towards Juan-les-Pins. The two Mercedes hurtled after it, engines blowing with an elephant-like roar, headlights picking out their quarry.
"Francis, let's move."
"Why?"
She sat stiffly at the wheel, refusing to look at the windscreen.
"They're crazy, Paul."
"They're trying to be crazy, that's the point. We need more evidence."
"Evidence?"
Francis hunted the gearbox until I rammed the lever through its gate.
"On top of everything else? Just keep going.
We followed the deranged motorcade as it moved along the beach road. Waves broke on the strip of sand, their foam sluicing through the debris of beer cans and forgotten rubber flippers, where the aging Picasso had once played with Dora Maar and his children. The rotating beam of the lighthouse at La Garoupe swept along the shore, illuminating the closed bar cabins and the low sea wall. Francis slowed when one of the limousines ran alongside the Audi, jostling it as the second Mercedes accelerated and braked, lunging at the rear bumper. On our left, across the railway line, was the apartment complex of Antibes-les-Pins. A single light shone above a balcony, where some insomniac neighbor of Isabel Duval sat alone in a high-security apartment. I searched the balconies, distracted by a rush of noise as the Nice to Paris Express emerged from the darkness. It thundered past us in a roar of steel rails and sped away into the night. Stunned by the sound, Francis lost control of the car as the black vacuum in the wake of the express sucked the BMW from her hands. She gripped the wheel and shouted, "He's going to crash! Paul!"
"Where?"
She pointed to the road ahead, where brake lights flared in alarm. The Audi overran the stone curb, struck the seawall, and whirled into the air before plunging onto the beach below.
This ends side two of cassette 8 of Super Can. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 9.